Does anyone have anything to share or ask? Or complain about, or whatever. I'd like to talk a little bit about, maybe we can say Beethoven. Someone asked me in a note yesterday about equanimity. The question was, what is it? Which we can say is the right question. And there's sort of hints of that around, like in the Buddhist tradition, the last thing on almost every list of what's good is equanimity, including factors of awakening and the Brahma-vihara. The vihara is like a resting place or abode, place you can live or rest into, and then Brahma is sort of expansiveness, so expansive resting place. The fourth one is equanimity, which I think we must need a different word because it doesn't really sound like it goes together. Equanimity and like a boundless resting place, a resting place of expansiveness. Equanimity. I think partly because the equa, also the nimity, but the equa, equal, okay, we got to be equal, we got to start measuring, you know, in order to be equal. One of my teachers will give this advice when someone is like about to go off into something, some big, hard, new chapter of their lives. They'll be like, can you give me like some advice, please? You know, some secret mantra or something. And his response is, don't freak out. Don't freak out. Which is good, and it's good when that's the only thing you're given to work with. Like, you have to, like, don't freak out. You kind of shake it in case there's something more inside. Like, don't freak out, come on. You've got to be kidding. And then it's like, oh yeah, don't freak out. And then again, oh yeah, don't freak out. It takes a lot of the air out of our big problems. Just like, don't freak out. So instead of just copying my teacher and writing those three words on the paper, giving the answer back, don't freak out, equals equanimity. I was just feeling, so then what is it that makes us want to freak out. Or what is freaking out and what is not freaking out? What does that mean? So I might just leave that as a question first and read a bit of a poem. Called Pause. Because it feels, at least this week, it feels to me so much like things like, okay, this heat and looseness that usually we would just sort of casually call effort in relaxation, and they sound like opposites, and how much to put where, and just more as questions rather than as amounts or something like, how, what is heat, what is looseness, how does it work together? And I'd like to talk a little bit more about looseness. I talked a little bit more about heat the other day, but also looseness. So Pause, also by Naomi Shihab Nye. And I love how she kind of tricks us into going very deep by using ordinary language and ordinary situations. So again, I think we're in Texas, and she's with her family, and they're driving, which is sort of what you do in Texas. You've got to use all that gas, all that petrol. The boy needed to stop by the road. What pleasure to let the engine quit droning inside the long heat, to feel where they were. So some of the English is not the easiest words. So they're on a long Texas road, and it's hot again. The boy needed to stop by the road. What pleasure to let the engine quit droning, inside the long heat, to feel where they were. So when we sometimes feel like we need to stop for some reason or other, probably the boy had to pee. And even I like how she doesn't say it, but almost the feeling of turning off the engine is almost the feeling of relief when you have to pee and you pee. It's like, ah, oh, yeah, the engine's off. And just the naturalness of looseness and of relief. And that then we can feel where we are. So sometimes we find ourselves, for some reason, we have to stop. Like Odelaji was saying yesterday, sometimes life bursts our bubble, even the bubble of retreatness, or the bubble of programming. And we have to stop, and we get out, and then we can feel where we are. Sometimes she was struck by this, as if a plank had slapped the back of her head. So a plank would be like a flat, long piece of wood, boom, on the back of the head. So sometimes she's struck by this as if a plank had slapped the back of her head. What exactly she struck by, we're in a poem. The feeling where they were, the engine that stops droning, the pleasure, like the being somewhere after being in the programming, it's not specified, I don't think. They were thirsty as grasses, leaning sideways in the ditch. Big blue stem and little barley, Texas cup grass, hairy crabgrass, green sprangle top. These are names of grasses. She doesn't tell you that, but since if English is not your first language, I'm telling you. I'm ruining her joke a little bit. She could stop at a store selling only grass names and be happy. They would pause, and the pause seep into them. Fence post, twisted wire, brick chimney without its house, pollen taking flight toward the cities. Something would gather back into place. Take the word home, for example, often considered to have an address. how it could sweep across you, miles beyond the last neat packages of ice, and nothing be wider than its pulse, out here, everywhere. The boy looking away from her across the fields. Can I read the whole thing again? Okay. What about some of the English words to get you ready? Chimney, a brick chimney without its house. Pollen. Okay. Pause. The boy needed to stop by the road. What pleasure to let the engine quit droning inside the long heat, to feel where they were. Sometimes she was struck by this, as if a plank had slapped the back of her head. They were thirsty as grasses leaning sideways in the ditch, big blue stem and little barley, Texas cup grass, hairy crab grass, green spangletop. She could stop at a store selling only grass names and be happy. They would pause, and the pause seep into them. Fence post, twisted wire, brick chimney without its house, pollen taking flight toward the cities. Something would gather back into place. Take the word home, for example, often considered to have an address. How it could sweep across you, miles beyond the last neat packages of ice, and nothing be wider than its pulse, out here, everywhere, the boy looking away from her across the fields. Did the last part come across? Because she's leaving lots of gaps, I think, on purpose. So, the pause seeping into them. Seeping. Exactly like what Adelia keeps saying, like arriving and then more arriving. So I notice I felt more rested than usual starting the retreat, and more rested the first day, and also the second day, and again the third day, and again the fourth day, and I'm still more rested whatever day I'm here now. I've been here longer than most of you, by 1 or 2 days. It keeps seeping in. Something gathered into place, something would gather it back into place. So I feel something is gathering back into place day by day. And then she kind of leaves a gap and just goes straight into a new sentence and a new word. Take the word home, for example. And she has home in quotation marks. Often considered to have an address. Right? We assume about home that it is a place. And then you may have to think of United States and Texas and a long road with maybe a 7-Eleven. Or some kind of shop like that, every whatever 100 miles or something. And the one thing that they have lots of is bags of ice, because it's really hot. And people will refill their cooler and put in their beer or their whatever. So take the word home, for example, often considered to have an address, how it could sweep across you, miles beyond the last neat packages of ice. And nothing be wider than its pulse, out here, everywhere. The boy looking away from her across the fields. So I feel like I love how she's making sure we realize how out there we are, how there's nothing orderly to remind us of familiarity in any outer way. The neat packages of ice, anything neat and tidy is miles away. And still, home could sweep across you. It could come and get you. like the sky. And nothing be wider. So she's going for that vastness and the horizon that's not, the edge that isn't one, that vastness. But then she's not leaving us with that as an abstract or something that's purely cold. It's, she's not letting us have any escape, because it's so easy that vastness would be an escape. If we're comfortable with vastness, it's usually an escape. If I identify that as my, oh yes, vastness, that's my address. That's my neat packages of ice. Vastness, beyondness. If I feel comfortable with that, it's probably some kind of habit escape. So she's reminding us nothing could be wider than its pulse. Pulse, like bum, 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 bum. It's not just alive in some kind of abstract beyond kind of way. It's alive with a rhythm, like a creature, like an organism, that we maybe are now part of. We found out. It swept across more like a realization that I'm part of this wide pulse. Nothing be wider than its pulse. And then she's, again, like out here. So we're way out beyond everything. And then she says everywhere. So here, not different from there. This so out there that we're everywhere. And then she's right back with the boy. There's a boy suddenly again. And then again, there's not like any normal comfort anywhere. There's the boy again. It's ordinary. There's a detail. And the boy is looking away from her across the field. They're not comforting each other. They're both, or he is looking away. She might be looking at the boy. He's looking away across the fields. So this sort of impossibility of the small and the big. And she keeps kind of, like Odelia G will have us sort of toss our packet of legs until it's really like a soft clay or the one thing. So it's like we're out here, everywhere, and then it's like, yeah, and here, and a boy, and looking out across the fields. Well, I think that's mostly what I want to talk about today, so, but I'll start with trying to answer in a few lines with your question. So, okay, one easy way into it would be to say, so when we got hurt in a specific situation, we get hurt in a specific situation. A specific rock. So that specific rock that bounced off that rock and hit me right here when I was 8 or whatever. It's a specific situation with the bad boys of the neighborhood, William and Fosse, they were called. We were trying to get apples out of our big tree at the rock. We got hurt. We get hurt. I got hurt. And because there's a naturalness with something that's beyond the details, something that's big, something bigger. That's true. And we can kind of dissociate into that because it's a hassle to deal with the details and the people and the frictions and the specific situations where we can and do get hurt. And so then we practice and we get some ease by going to the big mind, let's say. And there's something true and something false in that. And so if we're feeling really so easy to be with the big, and we don't feel also some kind of the power of it that's impersonal but willing to get personal, kind of, there's something flat. and dishonest. And so I'm just asking you, me, all of us, to feel for two hidden fears. So a fear of the small and a fear of the big. I have friends and students who, as children, were not like held. They weren't given a hug. And sometimes it's literally just they weren't given a hug. Sometimes ever. They were never given a hug. As far as they remember, they were never given a hug. And they're still able to walk around like they seem to be normal people. Somehow they made it through. Or they weren't given some other kind of hug. Like they weren't given, like, you feel that? Okay, I can feel you feeling that. And so if that's someone's upbringing, so I think of one of my friends like that, she has an attraction towards the vastness, and it can easily be destabilizing, both. But she identifies with the rightness of ideas that talk about the vastness and the impersonal and the abstract, the not-self. And so then it's been a process of letting those ideas start to crumble to realize that not-self is not here or here, but not-self crumbles all the ideas, the real not-self. It can be that someone, it wasn't that they didn't get a hug. They might have gotten too much of a hug, or they might have gotten they had contact, but it was hard, or it was not actually in tune with what they were going through. Someone else gave a different feedback that was their own bubble. So there was no actual meeting. So whatever way it can happen, and it happens to all of us at different times, different ways. I think it happens to all of us. It can contribute to that orientation around the painful, and then we're looking for an escape of some kind, one or the other, to go into the details, the small, more towards control in the details, or more towards control in the abstract or the impersonal. I get control by feeling far away or pretending that I'm beyond that. It doesn't really hurt me. It's not my feelings, even some kind of abstraction or some kind of reduction. And so we have this paradoxical situation. We have this paradox of needing to feel safety and needing freedom even more than safety. And I think if we could just kind of understand that, again, it doesn't have to be in conflict. It's usually posed in conflict. You're either safe or you're free. So as parents, your own parents or yourself as taking care of other people, it can easily happen. We feel responsible, and so we keep making safety more and more and more important, at the expense of freedom. So one of my favorite people that I mention sometimes, Jacques Lucieron, a French man who got blinded at the age of 8 in an accident. And he said one of the best fortunes of his life, the good fortune of his life, was that his parents didn't inflict on him, they didn't impose on him the tragedy of protecting him too much. They let him be in contact with the world. They let him stumble, they let him walk and run and go to the symphony and not keep him in the room so he's safe. And he talks about meeting another blind boy some years later, I think maybe when they were both 16, around 16, And this other boy had been kept inside. And it sounds like kind of pretty much literally kept inside. And we can so understand the parents with the blind boy, you know, not wanting people to laugh at him, not wanting people to be asking, not wanting him to get hurt, not wanting him to... We can so understand. And it's even hard to hear Jacques Lucerand saying, what a misfortune that is. And meeting the boy, that other boy at 16, and he was just a ball of fury. The boy. He was just a ball of fury. Fury is like burning anger and rage. Also so understandable. Being kept back from that impulse, that need of experience, experiment, even a need of mistake. A need of being the boy who's looking away from her across the fields. The boy who needs to pause, then the boy who needs to look away. So by the time Jacques was 16, and way before that, he'd found that he could do everything. Sometimes with help, sometimes with a hand on his friend's back. They would hike in the mountains. And he would see things that his friend didn't notice because the friend could see. And so... I think partly it's sort of getting away from trying to be safe and trusting that we can get sort of in touch with actual needs, like the need to stop by the side of the road and what that brings. It's not just a hassle, come on, we gotta hurry up. And the need to look out across the fields and not refer back to the home that is on the address paper. But so our kind of false ideas about equanimity are more about that trying to get safety, trying to make it be safe, even though it isn't. And by trying, making my project, my whole project could be, as a parent, make it be safe, even though it isn't. And then we start to feel like the fact that it isn't safe, which is an opponent, if I'm going to be going against that, it's an opponent that's going to win. So if I'm trying to make it be safe only, I can't move. I have one leg, maybe. I'm not in touch with reality. And so then I'm really unsafe. So part of equanimity is having two legs, at least, maybe more. I wasn't really planning to bring more of the story of Jacques Lucerand into this, but it just makes sense to follow through a little bit. Having the chance to go up and down stairs and be the one that he himself would find the key and unlock the door for himself, and he would play ball. And he would find out how to see. and he would find out how to move through a room. I mean, isn't that so much, obviously, so much safer? Having this, the skin open to what he says now that scientists start to say, yeah, there is something like a bat that human beings have called the obstacle sense that we can actually train, we can recover and practice and use that sense. Like we could maybe practice if we had to use the left hand, if we use the right or the right hand, or the you know, I could write with my foot if I had to. So we could recover this potential obstacle sense. And it's really fun to play with, knowing you haven't practiced, so you're not going to get it right, but to feel for, where's the watch? And so in his lifetime, having had that attitude, and we could even just say the in English and kind of common, at least in the United States, to have attitude means to kind of have a certain confidence. He's got attitude, she's got attitude. It's like you're not easily collapsing or being small or going off into some abstract escape thing. You're not escaping. Someone's got attitude. And so having attitude, the other day I talked about this word galvanize, which mostly means nowadays someone might give a political speech to get people inspired and encouraged to do what they know they need, what they know needs to be done to respond to a need. And it's just, it's so weird. I keep finding more and more very cool and interesting and poetically relevant meanings for the word. But galvanize, like, yeah, we can, and let's. Jacques' environment encouraging him to have contact with the world and to learn from that, rather than to hold back to be safe. Led him to keep on doing what we would certainly now consider the right thing, and the right thing, and the right thing being, you know, one of the main people in the French resistance movement in World War II, and then even in the concentration camp, being someone who was not just, I mean, how to survive that, if we think of safety, but his energy turning around and being like a kind of beacon, like a shining light, a light that's radiating towards safety for other people, towards really taking care that people don't, in that situation, unnecessarily suffer, which is sort of beyond our thinking, I think. Not to just fall into the small or the big, you know, either my own survival, some crumbs, or my, you know, people from France, but like the whole scene. How are we flowing in this? So, and instead of sort of to dissociate, or kind of also just to associate, where we stick to where home has an address. People from my country, whatever that means, people who meditate like me, or whatever. Or just this, an experience that's not really the experience, but what I associate it with. I think about meditation as this, and I have a mental version of the experience. So association getting caught up in the form and the details, the small, and dissociation, getting caught up in the abstract and the vastness and the no edge. So equanimity, what could give us both legs? What could give us the chance to be so loose and so strong? So tender and so powerful. In a way that's very personal and very impersonal. So this word attitude in the U.S. usage, I think, is better than the word confidence. I don't find yet quite the right word, but confidence, and if we can play with the, like, con is with, and fidence is like trust or trueness, like fidelity, high fidelity sound would be the sound that's repeated that stays true to the original. So some kind of staying true to the original with. So it's kind of in the word confidence. Con means with, fidence is like the fact of staying true to the original. And so in a way, we could wonder, like, why the con? What's the with part? Because it's really, why don't we just stay true to the original? I'm not sure why that word developed that way. But we use the word, like, confidence in. Confidence in myself, or confidence in so-and-so, confidence in the method. I'd like it to be that we could feel like staying true to the original mind with the small and the big, with the millions of mothers, like with whatever I've been through, millions of people also are going through. The with each other, the with connection, the with. Or with attitude. Staying true to the original with attitude. There's a saying, I'm not sure where it comes from, but it says we're all born originals, and most of us die imitation, as an imitation. As an imitation. So again, equanimity in a misunderstanding of the word, we'll find ourselves imitating to try to get it to be still and quiet. To try to not freak out, we'll imitate peacefulness, or we'll imitate so-and-so. And that isn't, and I hope that we have some value for sort of the wise words that are putting equanimity, upekkha, upeksha, as sort of this really important part of awakening. It couldn't be about imitation. It must be a much bigger story and discovery, recovery of a much more important quality than trying to be quiet, forcing quiet, imitating quiet. It must work with each our own individual originality. It must. And so when we are, and many of us here happen to be, not maybe everyone, and not everyone in the same way, but at the beginning of some new chapter kind of starting to establish itself. It hasn't established itself yet. Something new might be coming in, something old maybe somehow or other died or got ripped away or something, fell apart, something. And in the, it's like the moments of the poem pause, so the engine is off. The pee is going out. And we start to feel where we are. We start to feel where we are. And sometimes that difference in feeling where I am compared to what's been going on it can be good to be shocked like that. It can be helpful if it doesn't trigger the freaking out. If it can be like, I recognize something important here and I'm glad, instead of, how was I so stupid not to realize this before, or whatever. Or, I have nothing. I have nothing. And Odelia G mentioned how important it can be, just the simple realizing I don't know, with all its dignity. And that still might not help much. It might not soothe or oil the joints much, even though we could feel it has dignity not knowing. And honestly acknowledging I don't know, which is a kind of helplessness. But maybe we could allow, you know, kindness while things establish themselves a little bit. Just like she allows home to sweep across. And I think the way she puts it in the poem, it's a little bit out of nowhere. And they're in the middle of nowhere, like home, like what? Of all things. And so it could be in a seemingly sometimes a bit harsh and empty, like we could feel abandoned, we could feel rejected, we could feel lost, we could feel a failure. All those things could get triggered. I don't know anything, really. Anything important that I would want to know, I don't know. In the small or in the big, I don't know. Like where to live, what to do, like maybe, I don't know. In the big, what is life? I don't know. An escape, to keep with your question, Aneta G, could be like feeling that because I have experienced some goodness in no edge, that experience as if that's all, and that's enough, and that's home, just that nice feeling of being there in the vastness, that one flavor, instead of letting it like, whoa, it's that and more. So where it can easily feel like some harshness when things fall apart and we don't know, if we could feel kindness could sweep across. Into all those little spaces that now are spaces instead of filled with things that I know I'm supposed to do. So this not knowing, I want to talk about a little bit more how important it can be, especially with certain specific, really, really bad ideas that we've fully swallowed. But I want to talk about the loosening first, because the loosening is what can help us like let it come back up, like just got stuck in the throat and the feather comes back out. Like a cat fur ball or something. Sometimes I think we do feel the power when we feel most tender, and it can be a bit freaky. So sometimes we notice, oh, I don't know, for example, or we feel quite relaxed and at ease. Through resting, it can happen. We start to notice how much energy is starting to gather. And we get confused because mentally we think of rest as just only dropping, but obviously rest, after we rest, we feel energized. I still find this funny because I don't think, my mind can't quite get around it yet. Like, it's such a dropping and such a uplifting or energy filling sort of experience. That. and things, we stay with what feels true, we stay with not knowing, and things start to melt and fall apart, and that brings more energy back home to us. And sort of the last thing we wanted was to have more energy lying here trying to relax. Or it might be the head. And sometimes it's possible, and the best possible thing, just to kind of lie back a little more and just let that do whatever it does. It might be sexual energy, it might be some other kind of fire, it might be some kind of water, it could be anything. I'm not saying it's the only way to do it, but sometimes there's a looseness, like those of you who don't know me, I left the United States where I grew up basically when I was about 20, but really for sure when I was 23, finished college, and I didn't know that I was doing that, but that's what happened. And so from about 1990 on, most of like the normal references to mainstream culture, I don't always know what they are. So I hear around sometimes here and there, new Olympic sports, for example, is one of the things. It's also music and stuff like that, but new Olympic sports, even that they could create so many new Olympic sports is a new thing since my time. But there's one, and I think it might be called skeleton, that I think is a winter sport, maybe. Is it? Okay. Is it called skeleton? Okay. The person from Canada can say yes. And I think you get on some kind of a board and you just go really fast down. And the only way to do it is to be as relaxed as possible. I mean, that's the way to win. I guess it's also the way not to get hurt. But you go faster the more you give in to the speed, kind of. And that, I imagine it's not just the mechanical relaxing on some kind of really fast sled, but some also natural, and here we have our two legs and equanimity that's coming from somewhere other than the head. Because the head does need to be quiet, so that there might come like any good advice if needed, and otherwise shut up. But something alive, and not just the adrenaline, but like a, we have the Eros again, because it's very able and fluid. And subtle. That it can totally feel when we're not even quite off, but we could get off if we don't do something, if something doesn't happen to gather something back in that couldn't be measured almost in that speed. So you're just there, and lying usually is preferable at that point to really be relaxed, but whatever works for you, to let the energy just. Or the most simple, just go move like really fast and get sweaty, or just take a simple walk. So another kind of looseness that I love life being this long so far, at least, and hearing more and more these hidden, obvious facts. For some reason, we don't like to advertise this, but it's so, you know, it's not newsworthy. It's not in the newspaper. It's not in the headline. I've called this talk Beethoven, and now I can mention him. Those famous people, all of them, probably, when they're really good, and they have all that experience, they had enough contact and mistake, they had the chance, they weren't shut up in the room. And if they were shut up in the room, they were really in this other kind of equanimity that can just go for it. Can go for it. Totally loose and total speed. Total energy, total looseness. they come around from doing everything, all the most complicated, to the most simple. So there's a composer, Pauline Oliveros, who I think is, did she recently pass? Just recently passed, yeah. And she talked with such delight about coming around to just the most simple in her composing of music and conducting of music. Using the most simple elements, giving the great effect. So maybe there's some kind of need for achievement, and then something can relax and just get on with being good. Or maybe there's a way that we need to digest by doing all these complicated things, and then it's digested and we can actually use the energy that's been digested. The food got digested, and now, I don't know. And it's probably not one answer again. But that looseness with full energy can help us, for example, notice those things about nearly all those famous people who got really good. That when they got really good, they got really simple. And there's nothing wrong with those complicated symphonies or whatever either, but there is something. There is really some transmission in the simple ones in the later life. Not across the board, but sometimes maybe someone got that simplicity thing and then they got addicted to something, or what, something can easily go wrong as things get so powerful and refined. It's also so easy to get off track. We wish that we would be saved someday from trouble, but the more refined and the more gifted, and the more we then do what needs to be done with those gifts, there's now even more no guarantee. And so then, neither with the others, that great teacher who everyone said this, that, and the other, and they got off track in the end of their life. They just did. So also with ourselves, we're going good, there's some mastery, and we can use the mastery to feel with that sensitivity and responsiveness when we're getting off track. And just let that skeleton gather back earlier than later. So some of the bad ideas we've swallowed, I'll just kind of toss around. Toss like salad. So one idea that we swallowed, most of us, that you are supposed to be perfect. It is, I mean, what a joke. It is really very much a joke. And we really swallowed it. You're supposed to be perfect. Almost every word of the sentence is a big joke. But even in the most simple way, you're supposed to be perfect. Like, and someday you're supposed to be perfect. So whatever, like, you're doing your good thing and your good practice and it's so wholesome, but you're supposed to be perfect. And you're crippling your good practice because you're supposed to be perfect. And then eventually it gets loosened and hot enough to melt that. And it can be like a giving up, well, I'll never be perfect. Oh well. We might think of it as a slight failure, but this is good enough. And only, you know, like happens with so many gifted people, sort of after we're gone, it could be real. After all that time has passed, the end of our life we could see, or after we're gone, wow, what grace in that person. It's okay, because it was grace. We don't have to be self-conscious of it necessarily, but if we could not sort of like burn up our energy or use half of our resources in, you're supposed to be perfect. And then we can also just ask, perfect? If we were supposed to be perfect, we could also, like, then what do you mean, perfect? And that's another whole world of a question. You're supposed to be perfect. What do you mean, perfect? really, what do you mean? The fact that we could go along knowing we don't know what perfect is, and so it's like a dust magnet or something, a dust ball. It just will keep collecting little bits of lint, little bits of dust about any possible idea of what perfect might be. It just gets more and more of them along the way. We agree, we don't agree. What is perfect? Another kind of thing I think that we might sometimes assume when we entertain the possibility that we do need freedom even more than we need safety, and we need to let the gifts that are in us be alive. And so equanimity, another word for it, almost could be passion that is unleashed in its innocence, we'll say, using a word that one friend used today. Our gifts completely unselfconsciously just gift, their giftedness, just the love of life unleashed and met and meeting completely. Total body contact, like on the skeleton board or whatever it's called. What is the thing called? A slide?
A sled.
A sled. It's just a sled. Okay, cool. It's an old word. So if we would start to think, yeah, freedom is also a need, even more than safety, having soothed our alarm system often enough and well enough and thoroughly enough that we could recognize the need for freedom, the need to let ourselves run out into the world or dissolve into the world or whatever. An assumption that because it's so deeply natural, this freedom, we can feel that, then we should somehow kind of know how to do that. That we must somehow already be good at being free once we get into the swing of it. And we can also see that obvious fact all around, that where there's freedom, usually there's a lot of blindness in ourselves too, and kind of not running out into life, enclosing ourselves. When there's political freedom that we didn't fight for, well, can't really be bothered to express myself or to whatever. So if we could feel that there's quite some training that we might need, getting a taste of freedom and the need for it and the love of life, letting that release, but still quite some training involved in, imagine that your energy could move as fast or as fully, like full out, if needed, just for no reason, as you might for a reason. Like there's a snake. But there's not because of some fear, not because of some problem, not because of some emergency. You would just be like that complete. I think it makes sense that we need some training to get there. Just like when people and animals have been caged or enslaved, it's not obvious what to do when you get out of that cage. It's like we need, again, the experience and the contact and the mistakes to inform our skeleton belly. And then I want to say this shortly and carefully. This idea that I think we have swallowed. Once we get past some assumption that we can't get enlightened, so there might be an assumption that, oh, I can't get enlightened, or I don't want to get enlightened, or who cares about enlightenment? If we get past that, so to speak, to the place where we know enlightenment is available for you. But then the idea that is usually with us is I can get enlightened, which is another big joke. When we can start to feel already, I think, that the process that we could call awakening or enlightenment, even a small moment that feels like some kind of awakening, a shift of insight, or just that meeting the world without holding back or without grabbing, so in equanimity, is not something I can get. The I that would want to get it is gone, is exactly gone. And it's gone because that tendency of getting is cooled off. And so I feel like it's important to know it's that experience, that freedom is available to us all. And the statement, I can get that, is a joke. And if we could feel how the thought that I can get that, then we're comparing, there's something uneasy. And there's pressure and so on. And if it's not a getting and not an I, if we let that joke come apart, because it's not so funny. And I think it may all come down to one last idea of unpleasant equals bad, pleasant equals good. This kind of assumption or this kind of map that we swallowed. And we know it's not even true in our own experience. And so just letting our own experience unravel that one. It doesn't mean unpleasant good, pleasant bad, but just checking our own experience. When we're in the map of pleasant equals good, equals progress, equals happy even, and unpleasant equals unhappy, or the opposite of progress. How that is, and whether it's true. I mean, whether it's really true for you. Are there any questions or anything to share before we end? So I'll just read a little bit of a Mary Oliver poem called Mindful. Some of you must have heard this. Every day I see or hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in a haystack of light. It was what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, the fearful, the dreadful, the very extraordinary, but of the ordinary, the common, the very drab, the daily presentations. Oh, good scholar, I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teachings as these, that untrimmable light of the world, the ocean's shine, the prayers that are made out of grass. May our practice and our lives be dedicated, unleashed into the momentum of awakening for all, including ourselves.